This is the SF Signal Podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and a Hugo Award winner. And today I have a very special guest for our listeners. He is the multi-award winning author of The Forever War, January Fires, and Camouflage. His latest book is called Work Done for Hire, and that's out from Ace Books. He's a Vietnam vet. Thank you for your service, sir. He's a teacher and has been writing since, I think, 1970. And of course, I'm talking about the SIFLA Grandmaster, Joe Haldeman. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine.
I want to thank you for coming on tonight. This is a huge thrill for us.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Actually, I was out with friends having a spaghetti dinner, and that came to a decent end, and I just shagged over here.
Well, you know what? I do love my pasta as well, so I completely understand. I wanted to start off with a question real quick. What's it like being a grandmaster?
Oh, it's sort of like being a plain writer, except you're older and people have acknowledged that you've been around and written a lot and won some awards. I don't know. I suppose I should be more honored than I am, but I've been around too long.
Yeah, you've been doing this since 1970.
69, actually.
69, okay.
My first story came out in 69, but I wrote that in 67.
Wow.
And then I was drafted, Now,
some of our younger listeners might not understand what you mean when you say drafted.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Being drafted is when the government exercises its right to enslave you and put you in the army until you either die or get out 2 years later, basically.
And they don't do that anymore.
Well, they don't, but they still have the right to.
Do they?
I mean, not get too comfortable here.
Oh, so could they reinstate the draft?
Well, they would have to rewrite the Selective Service Act.
Ah, gotcha.
They write new laws all the time. I just don't trust any government.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously the draft was there for many, many years. Now we have a volunteer army.
So we have. But if we had, you know, different social situation, I don't think that would be the last thing to go.
Understood. So you started writing. What made you decide to start writing the stories?
I've always been a writer. I was writing when I was in first or second grade.
Okay.
Just kept writing.
What did you write in first or second grade? Did any of it get published? Did the teachers just put it up on the wall?
No, I wrote poetry, and my mother copied it all into books for me, which was a labor of love, I suppose, rather than literature. But it was, you know, for a child, it is important that they have an audience, an appreciative audience.
But I have to tell you, that's an awesome mom.
Oh, yes, indeed, she was.
Wow.
It's always on my side. You know, it's something you take for granted if that's what you have with your mother or father.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I know now that it's not something everyone can assume is going to be true in their life.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm curious now, since your first published piece, how many have you published? How many books? Let's start there. Do you know?
You know, I'm not sure. It's around between 25 and 30, and it depends on how you count them.
Okay.
So I wrote one book that was a perfectly good book and never appeared. So, you know, and I've written various versions of some of the books that came out in different manifestations. But it is, it's more than 25 and fewer than 35, I suppose.
And how many poems?
Poems?
Yes.
Oh, hundreds.
Hundreds, okay.
I only have one book of poetry out, and I have another one that I've assembled, and I keep fiddling with it. It's a much bigger book, and I have a couple of people who want to publish it, but I just have to take out the time from my other things to actually put it into a nice manuscript and box it up and send it off. But that'll be 150 poems or so, so quite a few.
Well, now that brings up an interesting question. What's a day in the life like for Joe?
Pretty lazy. Yeah, I get up around 4:30 or 5 in the morning.
Oh, so you sleep in. Okay.
Yeah, you know, it used to be 3 or 3:30. But I'm getting old and need more sleep. So I get up and I make some coffee and turn on the computer and basically catch up on the email and blogs and stuff like that, which is, you know, fun, basically.
Sure.
It's not hardcore stuff. And then after I've answered all my email, I make some breakfast and then I get on my bicycle. And I live in a place where you can bicycle during the daylight. Oh, I don't know, 360 days out of, well, 350 days out of the year in the morning. Then in the afternoon, it rains and all that. But in the morning, I bicycle to a coffee house, basically. And I sit and drink coffee and write. And two of my coffee houses serve beer. So along about, after a few hours, I switch to beer. And then I pedal home, or I may not. Sometimes I go out places, and every Saturday I have an art morning where from 9:30 to 12:30 I go to a figure studio and draw and paint with a model, which is a lot of fun, I've got to admit. I've been doing that for about 30 years, and it's very satisfying.
I bet.
Yeah.
Now, yeah, I mean, you've officially said that you're writing in a coffee house. So you're like every other writer now. We all go out to the coffee houses and we sit there with our laptops and we write.
Well, there is a little difference because there are other people writing in these coffee houses. Usually this is a college town and it's also a writer's artist's town.
Mm.
And so, yeah, they're like, you know, the cockroaches under the floorboards, you know, they're there. You just don't have to think about them all the time, but I don't talk to any of the other writers. Most of them are probably students.
Okay.
And I don't know. I just put my nose in my notebook and write away. I write my rough drafts with a fountain pen and bound blank books.
Wow.
Wow. Well, slow writer. I might as well have fun while I'm doing it.
I can't. And it's basically, it comes down to when I was little, I broke my right hand. And just when I was learning how to write.
Oh, yeah.
And my dad would not let the nuns let me write with the left hand.
Yeah.
And so I never really caught up. My handwriting is horrible. Just absolutely horrible.
I wonder what the effect would have been if you had been allowed to learn with your left hand. Might it have changed your outlook?
Yes, because when I played baseball, I would have been a southpaw pitcher.
Yeah, right. Well, I was... Yeah, I should say I write in longhand, but that would surprise most of my high school and college teachers because my writing was illegible. In fact, it was so bad when I started to write for a living, I couldn't even read my own notes. My senior year, junior senior year in graduate school, my college notes were horrible. And basically, I met a guy who's a science fiction artist whose name was Jack Gaughan.
Hmm.
Great, great Irish guy, a lot of fun and everything. But he said, you know, I complained to him about my handwriting being so awful. And he said, well, you can learn, you can relearn how to write. I did. And I said, well, how do you do that? And basically, it's very simple because he says you change your pen to an italic fountain pen. And you can't write sloppily. There are only two or at most three ways that you can move the pen. So otherwise the nib gets caught in the paper fibers. And that forces you into grace. And it's an interesting thing because only for about a month it was very slow. And then my mind caught up with my hand. And so my writing is fairly elegant and certainly clear to read. And I write as fast as anybody else. But it's something I've tried to get some of my students to do it, whose handwriting was awful.
Hmm.
I think I succeeded once.
That's awesome. Yes, I can see where that would work. Now, I'm just curious, when you longhand write all these things, who transcribes them? Who types them up?
Oh, you know, I have tried that. I've had my wife type them up, and I've had professional secretaries and friends and so forth. But, you know, face it, I rarely write as much as 500 words in a day. And any jerk can sit down and scribble 500 words in 20 minutes. So I just don't bother. Because I want the responsibility for the final product. A couple of times without, you know, with the best of intentions, people who are transcribing my writing have dropped paragraphs, whole pages.
Oh, gosh.
Because, of course, you know, you're in a stack of handwritten notes. And if you skip a page and by coincidence, you know, the end of that paragraph makes sense with the beginning of the next one, they just keep writing. And if you are yourself not a very careful proofreader, then all kinds of odd stuff can get on there. So I want to be in control of the manuscript all the way to the very end.
Mm. Wow.
But, you know, I'm not prolific. I know writers who literally write 10 times as much as I do, and maybe 20 times as much as I do. So I say, you know, 500 words is a good day for me. But I know a lot of people who write 2,000, 3,000 words.
Oh,
and
yes.
When I was younger, I actually tried to write 1,000 words a day for a month. And I did. But those were long days. And sometimes the last few hundred words were pretty crappy.
So I have a ton of questions here for you. But before I get into them, and I appreciate you sharing that with us, because I think that there's a lot of folks out there who are going to hear that. You know, I think 500 words, if they're good quality words, are should be a goal for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Now, but before we get into all these other questions, let's talk a little bit about this new book. So, Work Done for Hire.
Yeah.
What's this about?
Well, of course, the title is a pun. And it's more or less explained on the first page of the text. That is to say, as most writers know, a work done for hire, quote unquote, is a piece of work that you write that is not, the copyright is not assigned to you.
Mm.
The copyright goes to somebody else. You are sort of being like a ghostwriter.
Sure.
But you keep the money. And so the story starts out, a guy who is writing a novel, and it is work done for hire. A Hollywood producer hired him to write this novel, and he said, fine. You know, he'd written a regular mainstream novel, which was critically successful and didn't make any money. And so he was out to make a buck, have some fun. And so work done for hire is that first meaning, but then there is also a sinister second meaning. He gets, because he was a sniper in the war, a combat sniper. I don't know if there are any snipers outside of combat, perhaps there are some that we don't even know about, but he was a sniper. And some unknown person tries to hire him to assassinate some other unknown person. Says this man is famous, but he'll be better off dead. And so he doesn't even know who this person is, except he's sending him money and sent him a high-powered rifle of exquisite make. And he's just sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop on that one. The police are not interested. The police think it's a publicity gimmick. And so, okay, let's see what happens.
Hmm. Now, to answer your question, there are snipers on eBay. And what they do is they snipe in at the end of the bidding to grab whatever it is.
Some of them are higher caliber than the others.
So what? This is coming out from Ace. Is this a hardcover? Is this a paperback?
It's hardcover.
It is a hardcover. Okay. And this is already out, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it came out about a month ago, I guess.
Okay. And what was your thinking on this? I mean, where did this story come from?
You know, I'm not sure. Like most of my stories, I just started writing something, and after a few pages, it was good enough to keep. And you know, I guess it looked like a novel. Sometimes they don't. I know. In fact, yeah, this started out rather obliquely because there was a whole chapter, which I think is very good writing, which I had to throw away. But it was just setting up this character and this situation. Then when I continued with the novel, I got to about 50 or 60 more pages, and I thought, oh, damn it, you know, I'm going to have to throw away that great beginning because it tipped too much about the story. And so I still have it. I ought to run it into a fanzine or something like that.
You should.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, Yeah, I'll have to do that ere long.
So you're doing about 500 words a day. You've been doing this for so long. I'm just wondering how do you keep fresh? How do you keep the ideas flowing? Is there a trick to it? Is there something you're doing that's just keeping those, you know, keeping the doors open?
I don't know that there's a trick to it. I think it's rather simple. In the sense that you ask a really good pool shark, how can you make those impossible shots every time? And it's, of course, he does it probably by missing the first 100,000. But see, I'm not sure where it comes from or how come I can do it when somebody with my education and latent ability and so forth can't do it. I think there's an element that's mysterious, but I don't think that being mysterious is in itself a mystery. There are a lot of skills that we have that we don't know where they came from. We didn't do anything to deserve them. It's just things that happen. And you see that in the people all around you all the time. You see people who, for instance, you see people who think of themselves as ideal parents, who really would love to be ideal parents. And their children wind up in penitentiaries hanging and, you know, with the best of intentions, they fail. And, okay, you know, not everybody can be a good parent. Not everybody can be a good writer either. Writing is relatively more rare in our culture than it used to be.
Sure.
I mean, and there's no reason why. I mean, there's universal education, and there's freedom to have the time to actually learn how to write, how to paint, how to draw, how to produce movies and so forth. Maybe, you know, you can be old Croc and say, well, it's because kids nowadays, you know, fill in the rest of it. Actually, it's, I guess there is an element of truth to that, in that we are pretty comfortable as a culture. And, you or I, or most of us, can go out and get a job without any real difficulty. And it may not be the job we want, but we're going to stay out of the poorhouse as long as we can drag our ass off to work every day. And then some of us who are really lucky in the set of skills that we have, we don't really have to work. I mean, writing is not work for me, really. At least not writing something I want to write. It takes a certain amount of effort. But, you know, anything worthwhile takes a certain amount of effort.
Yep.
You wouldn't want to play if you didn't have to exert yourself and try to figure out new ways to play and so forth. In writing, to me, is a form of play. I'm just fortunate to get in a situation where I get paid for it.
Now, is that what you teach your students?
Well, it depends on students. That is to say, I've taught in a lot of environments. But teaching... Do you know what the Clarion Workshop is?
Yes, I do. And I've thrown it out there before. I've talked to different people, and my friend Mer Lafferty just recently went through the MFA program, and it's essentially the same kind of thing, but it's broken out 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there kind of thing, where Clarion is very intense. And I've talked to different people about that experience, and a lot of them tell me that they come out of a Clarion or one of these really intense writing workshops, and they don't write for a very long time.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder about people like that. And in fact, I read that just a couple of days ago. Somebody was saying, boy, I got out of Clarion and I couldn't write for another 2 months.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you would not want to say, well, you shouldn't be writing in the first place or something like that. I think Clarion is such a pressure cooker that I don't care whether you're learning how to write or to ballroom dance or shoot ducks or whatever. After that 6 weeks, you don't want to do that for a long time. Now, I never had a Clarion, so I don't know. I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop, and that's meets once a week, you know, and you might write a story every 2 or 3 weeks, 4 weeks. So it's not anything like Clarion. But I've taught Clarion many times. It doesn't take the same skill set to teach it as it does to survive it. And yeah, it's an interesting thing. But I've it's something that I've encountered in various writing environments. The people who go through Clarion and actually produce, say, 6 stories in 6 weeks, they probably have everything they need to become professional writers if they want it badly enough. Hmm. But if they don't want it badly enough, it's just another set of skills which will crop up every now and then when they need them. A lot of people who write, who get through Clarion or another workshop like that, remain fans of writing all their lives. They're some of the best readers, and they're good critics and so forth. But whatever spark they had gets extinguished in the sort of, you know, nonstop requirements of production when you're in a thing like that. I don't know. It might have killed my creativity if I had done it when I was that age. I'll never know.
Okay. So let's look at some of these questions. What I did was I decided I didn't want to hog you all to myself, which is very unlike me. So I put out to the SF Signal crowd and community that I was going to have you on tonight, and that if they had any questions that they've been dying to ask you, that here was their chance. So John DiNardo, who is the, we call him our bagel overlord. He's the editor-in-chief of sfsignal.com. He threw a couple here. What's your favorite science fiction memory as a fan?
Oh, let me see. I'd have to sort through a lot of them. I think, well, both Gay and I have the same big boss number one memory. So back when we were teenagers, we went to our first science fiction convention, which was the Worldcon. It was the Washington, D.C. Worldcon in 1963. And we walked in to the hotel lobby, and there were 2 men fencing. I mean, grown men fencing through the lobby, and they were Isaac Asimov and L. Sprague de Camp. And we thought, oh, did we die and wind up in SF fan heaven? So that was the big deal, and that was one of my first moments in fandom.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
My first convention I walked up was a Star Trek convention. I walked up and, this was my first. I walked up and there was a guy dressed as a Borg smoking a cigarette, and that tripped me out. From John D. also, what's your favorite science fiction memory as a writer?
Oh, let me see. I think my best memory as a writer was the first time I sold a novel, The Check, when the check for this all of $750 came. You know, I thought, holy moly, I am now king of the world. But that wasn't a science fiction. My first novel was mainstream. But I guess my greatest memory as a science fiction writer would have to be when I won the Hugo for The Forever War.
Nice.
I mean, pretty predictable, but that, you know, I was aiming to get a Hugo for a novel, but I didn't expect it so early in my career.
That is awesome. That is very cool. Alrighty, Fred Kish, who's also from SF Signal, sent this one in. He says, a number of people such as Robert Silverberg have started to republish their backlist as ebooks, either independently or through small, primarily ebook publishers. You have a number of books that are out of print, such as Mind Bridge, All My Sins Remembered, The Worlds Trilogy, your collaboration work with your brother. Is there any chance we will see these titles back in print, so to speak, as ebooks?
Yes, yes, they will be back in print within a year or two. I've got a couple of publishers who have competing bids in on these things, and so we'll see. We'll see who has the most money. I'm such a sentimental guy, you know.
Well, what I was thinking was how far have you come? Because you were talking about that first $700 check, and now you're talking about publishers bidding on the books.
Yeah. Well, I guess somewhere in this vague area between 10 and 20 years ago, I was making enough money to live on from writing. And I realized I didn't need a lot of money to live comfortably. I mean, those are 2 separate things related by numerology or numeracy. And basically, I really, somewhere along Mind Bridge time, or All My Sins Remembered, I realized I was not going to run out of ideas. I was not going to run out of offers. And, okay, I'm going to run out of time. Everybody does. But, you know, I guess, what, 40 years ago, 35 years ago, I realized that I really had a very good position. As long as I didn't need a lot of money, I was in good shape. And as long as I didn't marry somebody who needed a lot of money. Because Gay has always agreed with me on that regard. We, you know, we don't need fancy cars or a lot of stuff. You do need books. We do have a house full of books.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
And you've been together now since 65, you've been married?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah.
This one is also from Fred. He wants to know, what's the state of the Forever War? I'm all tongue-tied. What's the state of the Forever War movie, and what's your involvement, if anything?
Well, my involvement is simply waiting patiently to see whether they come up with something. And every now and then they float me a check. That's okay. But the you know, Hollywood is not obligated to say anything to the writer. And they fulfill that lack of obligation with religious fervor. I almost never hear from them. You know, ask who's going to do the movie. I can't even think of the guy's name right now. That long ago.
Okay. Let's go to Paul Weimer. He's one of our book reviewers at SF Signal. And he said his first experience reading you was Tricentennial. And he said, it's a strange mix of ideas and future social commentary that still haunts him to this day. Where did the idea for that story come from?
Well, that's a very interesting one, because I don't guess this has ever happened since, or certainly before. But I was editor of Astronomy Magazine for like 2 months. And it was a golden job for someone who loves astronomy. I just lived astronomy like 18 hours a day, literally, trying to get this magazine back up on its feet. And that didn't turn out too well. But one thing that happened while I was there was Ben Bova had just become editor of Analog. And he sent me this oversized black and white Xerox of a cover painting. And he said, this was going to be for the 200th anniversary of the of America in 76. And he wanted a story called Tricentennial that involved this picture. And I said, because it was going to be a cover painting, I said, great, you know, I'll do that as soon as I can. And I left the job at Astronomy and wrote that story. And the funny thing is, he sent me, I was going to write the story. He sent me the actual picture rather than a black and white Xerox. And it was all very strange, because it had there was a planet, the Earth. And, well, there were geometries involved in the cover that made it absolutely unusable. And I had to completely turn the story around and write something off the top of my head as fast as I could to hit the deadline. And it turned out to be one of my most enduring stories. And I'm not sure why. It may be because the cover painting was very good. It's by Rick Sternbach. And so I had to make a story that was worthy of the painting.
Very cool. Okay. This next one is from Jay Garman, who's also from SF Signal. He's asking, how has your painting influenced your writing and vice versa?
Well, my painting takes time away from my writing. That's one thing. And my writing takes time away from my painting, too, on occasion. The two don't mix too well. Drawing mixes with writing pretty well, because I do have to draw machines and aliens and things like that to help visualize them for the writing. And I do complex diagrams to keep the various levels of meaning in the stories straight. And so there's a lot of graphic art that my readers never see that's associated with the writing at some level. I've been offered the chance to draw to go along with my writing, but I've turned it down. I mean, I can do it as a fan. It's no problem. But I don't want to get into the business as a professional artist because, A, I've got lots of friends who are artists in science fiction, and I don't think they want me stomping on their turf. A writer brings a name to the making of the art, and people would buy my paintings for my name who wouldn't buy them if they were just by Joe Schmo. And I don't want to be there. I don't want to be throwing my name around to take advantage of fans and such.
Well, now I was just wondering when you're talking about the art that you do that fans never see, have you ever considered just displaying that somewhere and letting maybe at a Worldcon or something and let people just see the art, not necessarily buy it, but.
Oh, well, I have done that.
Okay.
In Worldcons and local cons. Yeah. And I have local shows of my paintings and drawings just at the galleries here in Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
So it's like a fascinating hobby that really takes up a large part of my life and a large part of my pleasure in life. But I have no ambition as an artist. I really, really don't. For one thing, as I say, it would be hard for me to separate my success as an artist from my success as a writer who occasionally does little paintings and things, which is kind of embarrassing.
I understand. Okay. Also from Jay, how did you get your gig writing Star Trek novels, and why did you write them under pseudonyms?
Did I write them under pseudonyms?
He seems to think you did.
No, I wrote first. That's a two-part question then, because I wrote the Star Trek novels because I was in correspondence with Frederick Pohl when James Blish, who had been writing the Star Trek adaptations, when Jim died. And I'd been fairly close to Jim, and I knew Fred. And I was writing to Fred, in fact, when I found out Jim had died. And I said, well, now who's doing Star Trek now that Jim is dead? And Fred wrote back and said, you are. And so I said, well, I wrote back and said, how much money is involved? And he said a number, and that was a good number. So I went ahead and did two of them. And then they wanted me to do like nine more. But I said two were enough. You know, I didn't want to be a wage slave, sort of mining other people's minerals. And now the Attar the Merman things were just weirdly different. Because this guy called me. I was at a Milford Writers Workshop in Michigan. And this guy called me because he had gotten the number from somebody, and said, how would you like to have your own series of novels, and I will pay for them in advance, and you'll get a certain amount of money, which seemed like a big amount of money. And I said, oh, really? Yeah. Okay, you can. I'll do that. But it turned out that this was work done for hire, and it had to be done under a name that we made up. Robert Graham is what we came up with. And it was very limited. It was adventure novels that kind of, I had to really fight to get real science fiction into them, and I had to fight to get the stupidity out of them. And it was just like tooth pulling. Like pulling your own teeth, really. And so after two, I said, you know, shoot me. I'm not going to do any more. And so he said, well, okay, I can't shoot you because now I'm dead. In fact, he died. So that was the end of that relationship.
Wow. Yeah, the first time I actually ran into that was I was trying to book a guest for the podcast very early on. And I come to find out the guest doesn't even exist. It's a pseudonym that's used by like five or six different authors who are all writing in this series of books. And I was like, oh, okay.
How about that?
I have a question here. This came from Facebook. This is a friend of mine. I'm gonna clarify that. His name is JT Evans. He's the president of the Pikes Peak Writers, which is here in Colorado. And he asks, how has being a CIFWA member helped your writing and or career?
Well, I don't think it's had much effect on my writing. It has helped and slowed down my career. That is to say, it's always a help to be acquainted with writers who have more experience and more contacts than you do. Mm-hmm. And when I was a brand newbie, I volunteered, or rather Fred Pohl volunteered me to be treasurer of SFWA. And so I did that, and I got to be on pretty good terms with a lot of old hands. And so that's a shortcut to secret information, if you will. And that's not true of writing in general, because most writers are pretty competitive and secretive even. But science fiction writers aren't. We tend to be, you know, we're already weirdos and shunned by real people, so we might as well hang together. And so that's the way it went. I went from vice president of, I mean, from treasurer of the organization to grievance committee chairman, again, because nobody else wanted it, and they just said, here, you have your hand out, take this. And I learned an awful lot there, because I had all the grievances that other people had with publishers. They'd hand them to me, and I could step in as sort of a third party, and I knew all the publishers by then, all the editors anyhow, and I'd call them up and say, listen, it's just between you and me and the Post here. We can straighten this out. You don't want publicity, and the other guy doesn't want publicity either. He just wants his grievance to be addressed. And I turned out to have a talent for that. I never would have known that, because I'm not a very sociable, you know, run for office in high school or college kind of guy. But I knew a lot about publishing, and I knew all the guys that were on the other side, so to speak. And everybody knew I wasn't going to put my job on the line or anything, but I was going to be the reasonable man in this discussion. And that worked fine. I did that for years.
Very cool. Cool. Well, I'm running out of time here with you tonight. So we started these questions with your favorite memories as of being a science fiction fan and writer. I'm going to close it with this one. This is also from JT. What's your best or favorite moment when meeting a fan?
Let's see now. There might be a certain level of censorship involved here.
Oh boy.
A fan who was not a writer.
Sure.
Well, let me see. You know, I think my favorite was a fan, I guess, about 25 or 30 years ago. She was deaf and blind. She'd been blind from birth and was handling herself very well. And I met her at a science fiction convention. And we sat down and started to talk. And she had so much to say and such an interesting viewpoint on things, because, of course, she lived in a world of abstractions, much more than a sighted person who could hear. And she was so moved to talk to me. It got to me that, you know, with just literature, we could bridge this huge gap, a sensory gap, a gender gap, a gap in experience. But we had science fiction in common, you know? Mm-hmm. And we talk about the world through the lens of science fiction. And various versions of that story have happened to me over the years, but that was the most dramatic one. And she became a friend who would never see me. No, and in a way, never even talked to me or touched me, but it was very moving.
That is amazing. That's a great story, and I think that's a great way to kind of close our interview tonight. I want to remind people, your website is joehaldeman.com. Mm-hmm. I believe you're also on Facebook. Don't know how much you do there, but there is a link there to your Facebook. The latest book, again, is called Work Done for Hire, and it's available from ACE. Why don't you tell folks, are you going to be at any conventions this year? Is there any place where they can go and see you in public?
You know, I should have written this down. I don't know. Yeah, I get around. I should have a list of that. I don't keep track of them. My wife tells me when I've got to show up.
I was going to say, have Gay send me an email and we'll put it in the post.
Okay, good.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before I let you go, sir?
Oh, no. Just say if they have any questions, you've got my address, and I'll be glad to answer anything that they send to me.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you, Mr. Haldeman. I appreciate you coming on tonight. This has been a lot of fun.
Yes. Thank you for calling me.
You have a great evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou, Romeo?
Angry robot.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.